This podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Travel, the global leaders in immersive, sustainable, small group travel experiences. Take yourself away from the world you know and be open, curious, fearless, and challenged. Be intrepid. Visit intrepidtravel.com to book your next trip today.
We all know that travel has its downsides. The carbon emissions from air travel, the home rentals driving locals out of the inner city, the excess of plastic from that mini shampoo in your hotel room to the plastic straw in your cocktail. But travel can also be a force for good. For countries with few other ways of making money, or which have been devastated by disasters, tourism can be a boost, not just to the economy, but also to the people. So today, we're going to look at the ways that you can use your travel dollar to make the world a better place. Hello, and welcome to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. I'm Uta Juncker, and joining me today are two travellers who know a thing or two about recovery tourism. Brett Mitchell helped get visitors back to post-earthquake Nepal in his role as the Chief Commercial Officer for Intrepid Travel. Welcome, Brett.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Anthony Dennis, the editor of Traveller with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, who loves a post-disaster destination like a storm chaser loves a tornado. Thanks for joining us, Anthony.
Well, good to be here.
So, Anthony, I know you've got form in this area. Do you want to start by telling us a bit about your Christchurch experience?
Well, I think a title like Traveller can play a really important role, along with the likes of Intrepid and other operators which have a conscience and have a relationship with destinations like Nepal, in terms of encouraging readers who may be a bit tentative about returning to a destination. So not long after the 2011 earthquake in, there were actually multiple earthquakes. It wasn't just one. There was one particularly devastating one, but then there were a lot of aftershocks when I went there a few months later to take a look at the recovery of the city, which was, as you will recall, was devastated, and even to this day is not completely rebuilt. So those stories that I was able to compile on that visit for, actually, it would have been, I think, another publication at the time, it did, I hope, help in some way to reassure people that it was okay to go back to Christchurch, even, you know, in the months after the original earthquake. And one of the great highlights of that visit was the shopping centre, the temporary shopping centre, which I think is still there and effectively became permanent, but was always intended to be temporary, which was built out of containers.
I remember hearing about this.
Just close to the Avon River and close to the devastated city centre, which you couldn't really enter at that time. So that was one of the real positives that I was able to take home and tell the readers at the time, and you know, it was just such a symbol of the city's creativity and tenacity that they were able to build this really groundbreaking shopping centre full of cafes, shops, and other amenities out of shipping containers. I'm pretty sure it's still there. Have a look online at what they managed to do. I think the fact that it survived so long, the container shopping, suggests how well received it was by visitors and locals. But it was a really great, perfect symbol of hope and hope for the future and the city's long term recovery.
And I mean, you went there quite shortly after the earthquake. What was it like? Was there still lots of, I'm sort of picturing lots of rubble and people living under sheets of plastic and something that wouldn't be a nice visitor experience?
Well, I suppose there was that voyeuristic value of being there and seeing the effects of whole city blocks where you'd visited on previous occasions, as in my case, had which had disappeared, had vanished. It was actually, I found it really hard to, even on a subsequent visit in more recent times, I found it very hard to navigate the city because a lot of the reference points had gone because the buildings had been either demolished by the local authorities or by the earthquake itself.
So what you're seeing over visits is a new city coming into being.
Well, that's right, and it's not often that a new city is particularly in this part of the world, is created. Not necessarily from scratch, but from the rubble of a devastating earthquake. But the task of rebuilding has been so great that, as I said earlier, the city still has not been completely rebuilt. I mean, it's a huge task for a country of what is 5 million people, a relatively small economy, to rebuild a city of nearly 500,000 people with scores of buildings demolished. So even if you go and visit today in 2020, you're still helping Christchurch's recovery, which actually says a lot about the impact of such disasters.
Brett, have you ever visited a destination that's recently been through something traumatic?
I have. My story dates back to 1999, and I was in Ethiopia. And as a young kid back then, there was no smartphones. I don't think there was any DFAT advice, and we wandered into Ethiopia. But they were warring with Eritrea at the time.
Did you know this?
No, we didn't know this. So we found out pretty quickly in the capital, Addis Ababa. Didn't really see many males over the age of 18 around. Didn't see any Westerners. We found out pretty quickly that, no, there was a war going on. So we thought it was best to probably make our way south through Kenya. But it was amazing to see as we went through and stopping off on the towns. I think one thing that will always stick with me was that resilience of the communities that we visited. Their men had gone to war, but, you know, they were happy as a community and they were sticking together. And we got stuck in one town for 2 weeks because buses were getting seconded to the border, taking up the troops.
Oh, wow. So there was no transport.
No transport out. We got to, language was a bit of a barrier, but to see the spirit still in that community, they're helping each other, they're helping us. You know, one family moved out of their home, stayed with another family so we could have a bed to sleep.
That's extraordinary.
It was incredible to see that community bonding together in a time of need. And, you know, I think that's sort of the human spirit. That's,
I have to say,
that's,
I didn't suffer the same privations in Christchurch. Fortunately, there were a few 5-star hotels that had survived the earthquake, so I did travel in some comfort on that occasion. But
speaking of 5-star hotels, Anthony, didn't you also visit the Taj after it had a rather nasty run-in with terrorists?
The Taj Mahal Palace Hotel. I was actually just checking the date. I can't believe it's. It was 2008,
so this
even
is,
earlier than the Christchurch earthquake.
This is in Mumbai, in India.
Mumbai, yeah. So I was there in 2009, just after the hotel had reopened. It needed a complete restoration because the attack by the terrorists on the hotel was very much centred on the guests of the hotel and the hotel. And subsequently, an Australian movie was made about the incident, which I actually, having been there, I've never been able to bring myself to watch because I spent my whole time staying at the hotel trying to imagine what it, and not succeeding, trying to imagine what it must have been like to be a guest.
Okay,
of,
see, that's
of
where
hotel.
You and I are different because I have stayed there recently and I spent my whole time not thinking about that incident.
Right. Well, I think because it was a year after. And I remember I had a tour guide who very kindly escorted me directly to the room where I was given an overview by one of the staff of all of the evacuation procedures. And the look on my face must have been... must have been one of shock and horror, because I noticed the guide was having a little giggle in the corner of the room as I was watching the demonstration. That was a video on the TV screen.
No, this is the bit where we freak out.
It was a little bit hard to not forget, because what happened there, especially a year or so after, because down the side of the hotel you could see all of the bullet holes in the side of the, because there was a shootout that went on for, if I remember correctly, more than a day or two. And also there was a very moving memorial to all of the staff who had died in the attack, and who tried to save all of the guests, including the hotel dog.
The hotel dog was
even mentioned in this memorial plaque.
The terrorists shot the dog?
Well, I'm not sure what the circumstances were, but I think the dog did die in the crossfire. But they'd erected a discreet memorial in one corner. And interestingly, I'm pretty sure I'd stayed there on a previous occasion before the attack, and all of the driveway procedures had been upgraded. They'd consulted the Israelis for the best possible security measures. So not only was the hotel completely restored after the attack, but also it probably now has some of the best security of any hotel in the world, thanks to the expertise of the Israelis, who know a little bit about security.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that, when an event like this happens, whether it strikes a hotel or it strikes a city, part of it is moving on, but part of it is also making the future guests feel comfortable. And one of the places that this happened is obviously Nepal with the earthquakes. It had these massive earthquakes. Now, Intrepid was really involved in a big campaign to get people to go back to Nepal. Can you tell us a bit about that, Brett?
Yeah, we were. Obviously, devastating earthquakes back in 2015. And for us, it was very much a bit of a spiritual home for our business. Very important. We got to know the people very well and the local communities. So for us, we thought it was very important to help in any way. You can't just rely on governments. I think businesses have a responsibility as well to do their part. And we raised a campaign pretty quickly called Namaste Nepal. And within a week, I think we had raised around $200,000. Another week later, we had raised another $200,000, so around $450,000. And Intrepid matched that again. So we ended up putting close to nearly $1 million back into the community.
Fantastic.
And what we thought was best around this was obviously the compounding nature, not just the trauma of the event as it happens, but it's the ongoing effects it has to the local communities. And Nepal has a significant amount of their population geared towards tourism. They rely on it for employment and for foreign currency. So
well,
for us,
as a result of the, if I may interrupt, as a result of the Australian bushfires, the crisis that we've just gone through, where we as a nation are now realising that tourism is very important to us as well. So we tend to think that developing nations rely almost wholly on tourism, and then suffer the consequences when there's a disaster or a terrorist incident. But we're now discovering that tourism is one of the three or four biggest GDP earners for Australia, and our image has been devastated by all of those images that have been relayed around the world. So it's actually not a bad. Well, it is a bad lesson, I guess, but it is a lesson for us in a first world country to realise that tourism counts here as well as in a place like Nepal or Sri Lanka or some other countries that rely on it.
As we become increasingly aware of how travel impacts the planet, it can be hard to make the right choice when it comes to booking a holiday without getting the gilts. Intrepid Travel has got you covered. For over 30 years, the company has been travelling the local way and giving back to communities. Better yet, since 2010, Intrepid has been carbon neutral, and this year we'll be offsetting 125% of its emissions. Learn more about Intrepid's sustainable small group adventures by visiting intrepidtravel.com.
And it's interesting to see how quickly or how long it takes a destination to build up that enthusiasm again. I mean, you've mentioned Sri Lanka with obviously the bombings, Nepal after the earthquakes. How long does it take before people are ready to go back somewhere like that?
Well, each destination is very different. And again, it's around the support of businesses and governments to get people back there. I think that's really important. I mean, you look at the Middle East as an example. I mean, Egypt, I think the employment of tourism employed one in three people in Egypt prior to the Iraq war. And you know, the Middle East has never recovered since then.
Mm.
You know, starting, we're seeing a lot of our Intrepid customers going back there now. But, you know, how long ago was that? That's 20 years ago nearly. Whereas, obviously, other destinations like Nepal actually bounced back pretty quickly. The year after that earthquake, we sent more passengers to Nepal than we ever have.
Really?
Yeah,
and do you think that was partly because you were doing campaigns or because it was a natural disaster rather than a terrorist incident?
Yeah, look, I think we, along with a lot of other businesses, put a lot of money back into the business around the infrastructure, fixing the trekking trails, and then going out with a positive message around marketing that, hey, business is back open, guys. You know, we really encourage you to go back there, and the people of Nepal need you to travel, just like, you know, people in Kangaroo Island really need people to get back to Kangaroo Island. So I think all of that plays a huge part in getting it back quickly.
And Anthony, I know that after what happened in Sri Lanka, Traveller was right on the front foot saying, we love this country, you know, we think it's a great place to go. What sort of response were you getting from readers? Were the people going, yes, I love Sri Lanka, I want to go back? Or
I think
you
need to get the timing right as a travel title, though. You don't want to jump straight back into print and say and pretend that everything's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we just we allowed a little bit of time to elapse. But I remember one of our writers wrote a beautiful essay about her love of Sri Lanka, and we had Sri Lankans writing to us, thanking us, and they were really touched that a newspaper would actually devote space to praising their country and also celebrating their country even and encouraging people to go back. And gradually we've begun to cover the destination again. And I get the feeling that things have stabilised somewhat in Sri Lanka since. But in a perverse piece of reassurance, one thing you can say to people in countries that have been been subject to natural or man-made disasters, is that there's another catastrophe around every corner. So that's one thing that we can be assured about in Australia. As dramatic as all those images of the bushfires have been, you can be certain that there'll be another natural disaster or some horrific event that will grab the headlines, and that in turn then makes people forget and move on. Sadly, it's a fact of human nature, and particularly in the social media age. You know, I do really feel terribly sorry for all of the victims of the White Island disaster in New Zealand, the people who died and were injured from the explosion of the volcano there, because that seems to have been totally overshadowed by the Australian bushfires. And yet it was one of the biggest disasters that we've had in recent years in Australasia. But that's been pushed aside by the bushfires. And for a time, that was a very big story. So but that's just the sad reality of it, unfortunately. But on the positive side, that does then encourage people to go back, because it means that their memory has faded and they're ready to go back. But I do think we are much more resilient these days.
It's a good term, and I think it's spot on, Anthony. I think it's not new, natural disasters, but what is happening is that it appears to be happening more frequently,
mm-hmm.
and the scale seems to be much bigger. And because there's more people travelling, the actual impact post the disaster is actually much more widespread and impacting so many more people. So I think you're right. The silver lining is that I think, you know, cultures and destinations are understanding this is almost going to be a bit more of a norm going forward. How do we continue to plan for it? It's not going to be a one-off. We actually should be expecting a lot more of this, but, you know, how do we get more mature in our travel habits and what we do to help?
Well, Australians are actually particularly resilient. I know for a fact that Australians were among the first groups of travellers to return to Paris after the Bataclan theatre attack there some years ago. And I was actually there 6 weeks after myself.
Yes, but, Anthony, you have this homing instinct that is a little bit worrying.
That was actually a private trip with my partner, but I obviously did end up writing stories. But one thing I found about being in Paris six weeks after that attack is it's amazing how quickly places do get back to some sense of normality, probably because there's no choice. I mean, what, you know, even Mumbai was 10 hours after that attack, everything was pretty much back to normal, in inverted commas. But it can be really difficult to put yourself in the place of the local people and imagine what something as horrific as that terrorist attack was. So it was in the back of my mind the whole time, particularly when I was travelling the metro and I was out on the streets. But I still really couldn't completely connect because it's just feels so unreal, something like that. So,
and because big cities have a rhythm and they will resume that rhythm quickly. But it's different when it's a regional area. And we touched briefly on Kangaroo Island before. And of course, at the moment, after the bushfires, they're going, come and visit, come and support us. And I think a lot of people want to help, but at the same time, I think, you know, a third of the island burned. What kind of visitor experience are you going to have? You want to help, but you don't want to you don't want to have a crap holiday, do you?
Well, no.
So how do you make those decisions?
It's your own cold, hard dollars. Well, maybe you wait and do other things before you actually head down to these areas. There's plenty of other ways that you can help. I mean, all of the donations by the public have been phenomenal. But at some point, you know, we all need to visit these communities. But you make a really valid point, you know,
The rebuild process is pretty important in that situation. We take tours through Kangaroo Island. And we haven't stopped. We've just altered our tours.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's right. And obviously our numbers are down going through there, but there's still people going on those tours, which is really encouraging.
People don't want to get in the way either, do they? So yeah, there's that factor. So it's not just that they're worried about having a crap holiday, as you put it. They're also thinking, I don't want to get in the way
Does emergency services need this bed that I'm going to go and sleep in now? What sort of feedback are you getting from people who are going to KI at the moment?
A lot of them actually had trips booked and they've cancelled and, you know, they've spoken to us about is it ready to go back? Can we go back or are we going to be actually more of a hindrance? And obviously we've been consulting with the local authorities and it is absolutely time to go back. So, and they've jumped on the opportunity. I mean, you know, these are people who understand the impact it's having. And therefore, it's been great that they've been able to jump back on and get back there. And we know it's an important time for them to go back.
And are they finding, because one of the things that you read about is that sort of the post-traumatic effects, that for some people it's really useful to talk about the experience they've had when visitors come and other people just don't want to do it. And you sort of think, well, if I go, do I say anything? Do I pretend nothing's happened? What do I do?
Yeah, it is, and that's just human nature, I think. But I guess, like anything, it's respect when you travel to a destination. You know, taking a selfie with a building that's hit by the earthquake behind you, it's not respectful, right? So I think it is good to go and talk, but just have empathy, understand, be sensitive, you know, and I think it is important. I think locals would appreciate that.
And I think it's also what we're seeing at the moment, which is something a lot of countries have learnt in the past, is that it's easy for other people to make sweeping assumptions, like this idea that all of Australia has burnt and there's nothing left to see anymore, and we're seeing bookings cancelled to Uluru, which of course hasn't been affected at all. So I think there's a lesson in there for us to not make assumptions about places that have been through something bad, to actually do some research and see whether it is a good place to visit.
Well, like I said, it's, you know, the bushfires are an opportunity for us to reflect on other countries, cities that have suffered disasters. You know, we've been pretty blessed, really, when you consider it. I mean, we are a country of droughts and flooding rains and fires.
And hail.
But this is an opportunity to just to see the firsthand the effect that such a massive crisis as this has on an economy. And, you know, fortunately, we have a relatively diverse economy, so we're not entirely dependent on tourism, like, say, like a country like Egypt. Or Nepal, but we will see the impact on one of our biggest, as I say, GDP earners. But going back to also another point that I made about Christchurch, in that, you know, even if you visit now, you're still making a contribution to the recovery, because Christchurch hasn't recovered. And I was just thinking, I was only a month ago in Hiroshima in Japan, and this year marks the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And a visit there is you know, it's well and truly recovered. It's actually a remarkably vibrant, enjoyable city to visit with this particularly dark history. But by going to Hiroshima, you are actually paying respect to a disaster that was 75 years ago, and you are contributing to its recovery as well. So it's not just recent events. It, you know, because people are still scarred by what happened there.
And disaster can become part of the story of a successful destination. So a country I've been to a couple of times recently is Rwanda, which of course had the horrific genocide back in the 90s. And before that happened, I think most of us had never heard of Rwanda. And it's become one of my favourite countries because it is a place that's moved on. It's stunningly beautiful. The people are amazing. And there's such a sense of optimism because they've seen the worst that can happen and they can see they're heading in a really different direction and they're all working together. So, and I think that's the thing about recovery tourism is when it works right, you get to be part of something that feels really, really good.
And you do really feel like you are making a contribution, particularly as a journalist, when you can go back and tell, as we can, the stories of recovery. It can actually be a very rewarding form of travel journalism to be able to, in some way, get the message out that it's okay to visit these places.
Yeah, and I think in a world of, you know, travel is so accessible now. You might have something planned. There might be a disaster. It's so easy to book somewhere else.
That's right. The choice is just enormous.
That's right. But you see, you just can't forget why you fell in love with that original decision and really lock it in to make sure you get back there,
even if
it is later.
And I think it's also part of the way we are changing the way we think about travel. Of course, we want to have experiences that feel great and are meaningful for us, but we also want to have a positive impact. And I think there's potential for destinations like somewhere like PNG, which has such a bad reputation, is such an amazing place to visit.
Yeah.
And the dollars you spend there can actually make such a difference to the communities that it becomes part of the reason for wanting to travel.
And, you know, Australia is actually quite remiss in not helping to establish a tourism industry in PNG. I think that would be a fantastic project for Australia to help what is, you know, effectively our nearest neighbour, because, I mean, it's only, you know, relatively small number of kilometres from Cape York. So
90-minute flight from Cairns. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, perhaps the lessons of the bushfire and the recovery of the tourism industry might play a role in helping directly some of these countries from a governmental point of view.
Because for once we really appreciate what a difference those tourism dollars
right.
can make.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we're all fired up about the idea of recovery tourism. Any tips or things to consider if you are thinking of doing this sort of trip?
obviously, I think Anthony touched on it before, you know, do your research and make sure it's the right time to go back. You don't want to be hindering any local recovery effort. And obviously you've got DFAT advice for that. But I guess my biggest tip would be to make sure you're giving back to the local communities when you're travelling there. So really make sure that you're spending your money locally with locally owned hotels or locally owned restaurants, not necessarily the multinational companies, because then you know the money's going directly back to the locals. And I think, again, that'll really give you a good sense of giving back when you're travelling.
Anthony?
Yeah, well, I think follow your passion is a piece of advice that I would provide. If you love a destination like Nepal, which so many Australians do, repay that love that you receive in return and go back to the country. I mean, I can't wait to go back to Sri Lanka. I know we've had other journalists. I'm very passionate about Sri Lanka. I mean, look at the response to Bali. I mean, Australians were really positive in their re-embrace of Bali after its two terrorist attacks in the volcano. Nothing will stop Australians going back to Bali. So if you feel passionate about a country that's had a hard time, you know, do put it on your agenda and maybe put it ahead of another destination and get back. Just make sure your timing's right, because you don't want to have a bad time, as you mentioned either, and they don't want you to see that you're having a bad time. So go when you know that you can enjoy it and enjoy the people and make a difference.
Well, that makes me feel inspired to pack my bags and spread a little happiness. Brett, Anthony, thanks so much for coming along today.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And thank you for listening. For more travel inspiration, head on over to intrepidtravel.com.au or to traveller.com.au, where you'll find stories by Anthony and by me. And for the latest travel warnings and advice, don't forget to check smarttraveller.gov.au. If you'd like to subscribe to Flight of Fancy, you can find us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast. We'll catch you next time on Flight of Fancy.
Thanks for listening to this podcast, brought to you by Intrepid Travel. Sign up to the Intrepid e-newsletter for more travel inspiration and to be the first to hear about great deals and competitions. Visit intrepidtravel.com to subscribe today.
Flight of Fancy is hosted by Ben Groundwater. Our guest host is Uta Juncker. This podcast is produced by me, Annie Dang. Audio production by Lap Fam. Extra audio assistance by Dave McMillan and Leah Samoglu. And our digital editor at traveller.com.au is Craig Platt.